Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, a crime and mafia podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau. Hope you're having a great day. We are back another week, another sit down. I am now 1 year older. I'm 32 years old. Had my birthday on Saturday. It's kind of a great way to start the show, right, Blackjack?
Sure is, buddy. Happy birthday.
Thanks, man. Appreciate that. Yeah, middle of the summer. We're ending, kind of the basketball season here in a couple of weeks. Football's on the horizon. You know, I've always felt like, and I think we talked about this on a show like maybe last week, where once you get to like July 4th, my birthday, July 10th, you kind of start looking towards fall, right? As you, you kind of just, I think, kind of pattern your mind to like, hey, you know, I'm ready for not to be 95 degrees every day. And like, you know what sucks, Blackjack, once you get older and you're like, unless you're like super skinny, you don't really deal with it. Even like at my svelte frame I am now, I still deal with this. But like, I always hate when you, like, you're getting ready to go out somewhere and you like walk out to your car and you sit down in your car and it's really hot in your car.
Oh yeah.
Like by then you're sweating. It's like, I don't really like that. I guess I need to get one of those remote starters so I don't have to deal with that. But, yeah. You know, I just don't like that. So give me fall. Give me 55, 60. I'm good with that. Is there a place on earth where I can go where it's like that? There's got to be somewhere.
Sure there is. It's just, I don't know if you're going to get it year round, you know? I mean, but it's, yeah, I always like that kind of Northern California weather in the fall. You know, it's like 72 during the day, like 52 at night, you know, kind of a little bit of both worlds. You can go short sleeves during the day and then, you know, get a little chill in the air at night. I like that.
Well, if anyone can, and again, there's always people out there that can recommend things. If you know of a place on earth that, it doesn't matter where, that is, it never gets above 60. Like that's my kind of place. Like I'm good there. Like I'm good with it. Just, you know, if it gets cold, that's fine. I don't mind being cold, but, and I'm sure a lot of people just say like, we'll go to Siberia. It's never warm there. But then again, with global warming, who the hell knows? But we're back. We're better than ever. It's time for another show. And we got another good one today. You know, the last 2 weeks, at least this week and last week, matter of fact, for the last couple of weeks, we've talked about some very violent people.
Crazy.
Yeah. I mean, we went from Kobani Savage to Anthony Casso, who, I mean, pretty much one of the biggest lunatics ever. And now we're going to talk about probably, if you ask, you know, people in mob circles, there was not a more violent group than the DiMeo crew. Anytime I talk about violence in the mafia, Roy DiMeo is always up there. And we're going to dispel of a couple of rumors today, I think, in this show. Obviously, we're going to talk about who Roy DiMeo was, who his crew was. And I think one of the things that I've always found interesting about Roy DiMeo was he's one of those guys that, did he make a lot of money? Yeah. Did he kill a lot of people? Yeah. He's one of those guys that we talk about where you want to be an earner and you want to be a leg breaker. He could do both. And it's what made him powerful. But I think one thing that I learned, and I think what all of you will learn, is that no matter what Roy DiMeo did, it never seemed like he was ultimately that respected in power. And I think a lot of it had to do with the family that he was in and the time that he was kind of at his height, just because Paul Castellano didn't really respect anybody, it seemed like, especially if you were a leg breaker. But we'll also get into a little bit. This is the episode we're going to talk about Richard Kuklinski a little bit. And we're going to dispel finally that Richard Kuklinski was not in the mob. He didn't do mob hits. He had no connection to the mob. And we're going to dispel that rumor today.
I know you've been looking forward to that because that is probably one of the biggest urban legends that drives you up a fucking wall.
Yeah, I'm kind of done with it because it's like anytime I bring up like who is a grizzly killer, it's like who is a mob hit, you know, it's like Richard someone mentioned Richard Kuklinski. It's like he wasn't in the mob.
Every time he does, Jeff just tags me in a reply. I'm like, oh, this is gonna be Kuklinski.
Yeah, because it's like it just gets old. It's like, and look, I get it. Like, there's a lot of, like, this business, like, the mob history thing, there's always a lot of people that spread misinformation. And, look, occasionally you know, you'll find something that isn't true. But like, Richard Kuklinski didn't kill Joe Gallo, Carmine Galanti, Albert Anastasia, and then Roy DeMay. Like, it didn't happen. Like, never. So we'll get into the connection that Roy had briefly with Richard. Before we get into Roy DeMayo, I did want to touch on something that kind of crossed my desk the last day or two. So Blackjack, I put out a tweet on the Sit Down account. I think it was Tuesday. And I talked about kind of how, you know, one of the big talking points in America right now is violence in cities, right? We hear about New York and Chicago and all these different places. And yeah. I put out a tweet that I wish these guys were still around because I feel like crime would be at a much lower level than it is. And I put up pictures of like the Gotti crew and Salerno and these guys. And, you know, some people like took it literal and they're like, yeah, you know, God forbid we don't have murderers and extortion people out there like those guys. And it was really just a broad thought that, and again, I'm not sure it's that hard to understand. The truth of the matter is, Blackjack, when people like Tony Salerno were around and John Gotti and all these different crews, I'm going to go ahead and guess that most of those neighborhoods that those people frequented were some of the safer in New York. I think it's fact, frankly. You know, those areas of Manhattan didn't have drug addicts walking down the street everywhere and, you know, people robbing people. It just wasn't happening. That was more the connection to the tweet. Again, you're always going to have people that, well, my great grandpa was extorted twice by DeMayo people. It's like, okay, well, maybe, but the all in all tweet was, and I think you could agree, New York was, I think, safer with the mob around. And I think it would be today as well.
Yeah. I mean, this just goes back to your general, not you, you know, the royal you, your general view on crime and the mafia's role in crime. Obviously, were these guys criminals? Yes, they were. However, they were not criminals that had an impact on the general public. Okay. These guys weren't out there committing random acts of violence. They weren't holding people up on the street, right? They weren't doing a smash and grab at a liquor store. And also spare me the meta theory of, well, you know, if the mob is doing this, then it impacts society in this way. I get it, right? I understand what they're doing is illegal. I get it. But yeah, your point is well taken. When you have a crew of these guys that, you know, is posted up on the club at the corner, yeah, no one's fucking around that neighborhood. You're just not.
And so, again, like,
yeah, general public, yes, you were probably safer with them around than without them because they were no threat to you.
For sure. And look, I know there are areas in New York that the mob are not in. And look, like East New York in the 80s, the mob ain't going to keep East New York safe. But for the most part, I do think they had a – and look, I think there's a lot of distortion with the mob where, like, I don't believe in every neighborhood they're actually extorting, like, family-owned business. You go up to places like the Bronx. Anybody that lived in the Bronx in the 70s, 80s, and the 90s, they'll tell you that the mob had a good – connection in the community. They were doing things in the community. They were keeping the community safe. Arthur Avenue, places like that, Belmont, those areas of the Bronx, they're totally different now. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, the folks and the community that are there, the family, whole thing, that's all gone. And it was really just a general thing. But again, with Twitter, we always have people that take a lot of things literal. But let's get into Roy DeMayo. That's our topic today. Should be a good one. Roy DeMayo on the sit down. Roy Albert DeMayo was born September 7, 1940. He was born in Brooklyn, New York. He was from an area called the Flatlands. The Flatlands are an area just north of Sheepstead Bay in South Brooklyn, really kind of right near you know, Marine Park, Mill Basin, just east of Midwood. So, you know, Roy was from South Brooklyn. You know, obviously, if you know anything about the mob, a lot of connections to the mob. He was born to a working class family, Anthony and Eleanor DeMayo. They had three boys. And Anthony DeMayo, Roy's father, was a hardworking guy. He was a laundry company a delivery man. He, you know, delivered linens and things of that nature. His mother, Eleanor, just kind of stayed home and cared for his family. I meant to say five kids, not three kids, five kids. Roy growing up was Blackjack overweight. He was teased a little bit, something that I think kind of shaped him into kind of the bully he would become many years later. You know, he would be teased as a kid, kind of the way we talked about with Tommy Patera. You know, kids get teased. Sometimes you're the kid that gets teased. You kind of embolden yourself eventually to not get teased. But Anthony DeMeo, Roy's brother, would protect him as he got older. And Roy really looked at Anthony as his, you know, older father figure. His dad was working a lot. And, you know, Roy realized that, you know, Anthony was someone that he could idolize. Anthony was a good guy. He was a bit older than Roy, and he would protect him. In 1951, at the age of right around 10, 11 years old, Roy's brother gets shipped off to Korea, and Roy gets terrible news. Roy's brother, Anthony, is killed in combat, and the family obviously took it hard. You know, they came and knocked on his door, and, you know, I think for a young Roy, you know, especially at that age, you're growing into your adolescence. You know, you obviously want good role models around you, and Roy's brother really was that. And it's really something that I think shaped Roy DeMeo into kind of the person that he was. He became emboldened. He became kind of a different person. And look, we see that in every walk of life. When a family member to that level dies, Blackjack, especially at that age, you know, you're kind of shaping someone that might go a different way.
Yeah, it's really tough, man. I mean, you know, you've got a brother who you're close with, and then to, you know, have him killed in action, you know, on the other side of the world. It's just, it's one of those things. It's like you said, it's a formative experience on a young 11-year-old Roy DeMeo, as it would have been on any of us. It's just one of those formative experiences that is going to, you know, I'm not going to alleviate him of any blame for what he became and say it's because his brother was killed, but it certainly is one of those things that it's just another domino that falls on the way to Roy DeMeo becoming who he becomes.
Yeah. I mean, we always see things that shape people. And this is something that really shaped Roy DeMeo. Around the age of 15, Roy starts kind of getting into trouble. He does a complete 180. He becomes the bully instead of the bullied. And look, Roy had some scores to settle for sure. One good thing, though, is he gets a job. He starts working at a local grocery store. Actually, at one point, worked as an apprentice to a butcher and starts delivering groceries around the neighborhood. Good thing about delivering groceries, this is, you know, the 1950s. This isn't we're going to ride scooters and cars around. Roy was pedaling a bike around, started to lose weight, get into shape. Becomes kind of a svelte guy and starts making a lot of money. It was said that at one point, Roy was making $100 a week delivering groceries. He was delivering way more than everyone else. And, you know, in the 1950s, that's kind of equivalent to like $1,000. So at 15, Roy was making money. Roy would obviously get smart with it. He realized that he could dole out money to his classmates and make some money out of it. So in the late 1950s, he becomes a loan shark in school, starts giving money out, get money back with interest. And that was his first real jump into some sort of petty crime. He would never have trouble collecting. Obviously, he was a tough dude. He had a pretty good reputation. In the late 1950s, he graduates high school. And by that point, Blackjack, he has a Cadillac. This guy's making money. And in 1960, he meets a beautiful woman in Brooklyn, Gladys Britton. They get married. And Roy's just 20 years old. But Roy would also get some more sad news, and this would, again, shape a young Roy DeMeo. Look, 20 is young, as we know. It's not 10 or 11, but it's still pretty young. Roy, by this point, lost his brother, as we said. In the late 1960, Roy's father would die of a heart attack. So this would kind of shape Roy from a family standpoint as well, because it would, in turn, have his mother leave the country. She decides, you know, my husband is gone. My kids are grown, and I'm going to move to Italy. I'm going to move back to Italy. So Roy really didn't have much of a family outside of that. So he didn't have much of a family by the age of 20 outside of his wife and young children.
Yeah, I have tried to understand what the mother did here with moving back to Italy, and I can't get my head around it.
Well, like, I think she probably could, Blackjack, just said, you know what, like, I probably have close family, you know, maybe brothers and sisters in Italy. I don't have a lot here. Roy probably said, you know what? Go do it.
But I mean, Jeff, I'm not saying that maybe he didn't say that, but you've got to kind of wonder, Like, you've got a kid now who is 20 years old. His older brother is dead. His father has just passed away. You're going to go and take his younger brother and move to Italy. Like, this dude is on his own. And literally, if you're not having thoughts, if you're Roy DiMeo, like when the lights go out at night, if you're not sitting there thinking, you know, no one's going to take care of me but me, right? Like, that's got to be the predominant thought in his head. Like, he can't count on anybody.
Yeah, for sure. And again, we don't, you know, at the end of the day, maybe he at this point kind of said, you know what, Mom, go do your thing. I'll send you money over. Roy was making money at this point. So I don't know. It's definitely concerning. But you're right. He had kind of lost his family. He had his wife, though, and they would have some kids. Around this time in the early 60s, Roy would meet a guy, Fred Denome. Denome was a mechanic in the neighborhood in Flatlands. He was a low-level associate in the Lucchese crime family. He did a lot of things, but one thing Denome was good at was stealing cars and kind of flipping them, you know, to other, you know, groups and making money off it. He could chop cars. He had a garage. And the Flatland Canarsie faction of Lucchese's, that's kind of what they dealt with. They dealt with stealing cars and flipping the products and flipping the parts and stuff like that. Around this time as well, as I said, Roy would have some children, including his son, Albert. So, you know, Roy was making good money. He actually moved his family out of Brooklyn and into Long Island. One thing that can be said about Roy DiMeo, and we're going to talk about how, you know, demented and evil Roy was in his work life, but in his private life, Roy was always said to be a great father. He would, like I said, move his kids out of Brooklyn. He didn't want them to kind of grow up the way he did. Wanted them kind of away from the life. I'm sure you probably saw associates of his kind of maybe bring their kids into it. He didn't want that for his kids, and he didn't want them to deal with that. So he moves them out to Long Island, to Massapequa. And around this time is when Roy meets kind of someone that would change his life forever. Roy meets he's hanging around at a bar, Phil's Lounge in Brooklyn, doing some low-level things, but making money. He had a good loan sharking business, and that was key. He begins kind of dealing with some of the customers at Phil's. And this is where he meets a guy, Nino Gaggi. Gaggi was a soldier in the Gambino crime family, and he kind of took a liking to Roy. Says, hey, look, you got this fledging loan business in Flatland. You're doing things. You could make a lot more money and be more successful if you come kind of get associated with somebody. You know, work for the Gambinos, work for me. And this was a great thing for, I think, both of them. This would elevate Roy. This would get him into a fledgling life of crime, make him more money, expand his loan business and into other things. But what it would also do for a guy like Nino Gaggi, Nino Gaggi was smart. Gaggi realized, hey, I have to up my coinage as well on the Gambinos. And this is how I kind of build my crew. This is how I become a capo. This is how I elevate myself. So everyone's prospects, Blackjack, were becoming better. And I think Gaggi was smart enough to realize that.
Yeah, I mean, I think these two guys were a perfect fit at the right time for one another, right? I mean, if you're DiMeo, you're kind of looking to get your foot in the door. You're making some money now, but I'm sure Roy DiMeo knew that there was a lot more serious money out there for the taking. And like you said, if you're Gaggi, it's just smart business, right? Because now DiMeo owes you. He's kind of indebted to you. He's going to work for you. It boosts your stature. It's a win for everyone, man. I mean, good decision by both of them.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, DiMeo also quickly realized that with his expanding business, he almost needed to create a little group of his own, a crew of his own. Because as powerful and people that make money in the mob, they realize if I just stay a soldier by myself, I'll do okay, but I got to look for more. And Roy and Nino would realize that. Roy would kind of first meet one of his crew members in 1966. He was at a gas station in Canarsie where he gets connected with a young hothead, Chris Rosenberg. Rosenberg was a Jewish kid who, you know, grew up in an Italian neighborhood. He was Jew only by name. He acted Italian. He, you know, he pretty much was Italian. He was only 16. He was selling a lot of weed. I kind of look at him like, if you've ever seen Bad News Bears, Kelly Leak, kind of like that kind of character, like just a hothead kind of, he he was always kind of doing crime and shit that he shouldn't do. And DeMeo kind of finds this Rosenberg and says, hey, why don't you start taking a little money from me? We could start, dealing weed in bigger amounts. You can start working for me a little bit. And I can expand my operation. So Chris Rosenberg would be a name to obviously remember. Roy kind of takes him under his wing as kind of his protege, if you will. And, you know, that's kind of what Roy did. He needed, he wasn't going to involve his own son. So Rosenberg was kind of a perfect kind of complement. By 1970, Gaggi and DeMeo were really starting to align. Roy was paying Gaggi weekly payments and really kind of creating different partnerships. By this point, Gaggi and DeMeo start kind of creating X-rated films. They get into the porn business. And this would create a bit of a problem between DeMeo and Roy kind of later, which we'll kind of get to. By 1972, Roy not only was partnered with Rosenberg and Gaggi, but Rosenberg would introduce DeMeo to several other people that he was doing business with. And this would create the DeMeo crew: Joe and Patrick Testa, Anthony Center, Freddie Denome was involved, his old friend, Henry Borelli, Joe Guglielmo, Vito Arena, and Carlo Perfetta. They would all kind of merge forces, start stealing cars, doing all sorts of things, really expanding the business. And by this point, Blackjack, the loan sharking operation continued to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Roy was funneling money through a credit union that he had a partnership in. He had all sorts of clients, including dentist's office, restaurants, flea markets, sportswear companies. I mean, this guy was dealing a ton of money out to a ton of people, and he was making money on all sorts of different fronts.
That's the name of the game, isn't it? I mean, you're out here, especially at this young age. You know, you've got a young family to take care of. You're trying to make money wherever you can, man. That's why you're doing this. At the end of the day, is to put money in your pocket. So whatever it takes to do that, Roy DeMeo was going to do it. He was effective at it.
Yeah, he really, really was. In 1974, Roy would have some of his first spats with real violence. They were stealing cars. There was a car theft ring that the DeMeo crew had created in Brooklyn. They were working with a guy, Andre Katz. Katz was a Romanian guy that owned a body shop, repair shop, and they were partners in this ring. People began becoming concerned with Katz because they found out that he had voluntarily went to the police and started kind of informing on Rosenberg and other people in the ring. The problem for Katz was Roy had a connection in the auto crimes group at the NYPD. And he tells DeMeo, hey, look, Katz, he's a rat. You know, he's going to start informing on you. You got to get rid of him. So Roy would order Henry Borelli, one of his crew members, to kind of put all this in motion. One thing they realized about Katz was he was obviously, like many of us, very infatuated by women. And women can weaken knees, as they say. Roy and Henry Borelli would find a woman, Babette Questel. She would kind of lure him to a hotel. And at that point, they would kind of take care of business. In 1975, she would lure him to a Manhattan apartment. That was where the DeMeo Gemini method would be created. The Gemini method was taken from, by this point, I just want to kind of throw something in. By this point, Roy had taken over Phil's Lounge. Phil's Lounge, the owner, got in to debt with Roy. Roy kind of takes the bar as payment. He turns it into the Gemini Lounge. It was kind of a social club bar for the DeMeo crew. So Roy establishes the Gemini method. He would take this Katz guy to a meat department of a supermarket. He would then stab Katz multiple times in the back with a butcher knife. He would then decapitate Katz. Rosenberg would take Katz's head and basically compact it in a cardboard box compaction machine. They would then wrap the body in plastic bags and put it in multiple dumpsters. The problem they had here, though, was they didn't do it good enough. Katz's legs were seen from the curb of a nearby store by an individual, and it was reported to police.
That's a problem.
The problem was nothing would really happen, though. They could only identify him through dental records. We know in the 70s there were no legitimate cameras or anything. So this was kind of the first body. And look, the DeMeo crew would become much better at disposing of victims, but this was the first real crime, Blackjack, that they would commit, first murder.
Yeah, and you know, Jeff, we talk about these first kind of murders on most of our shows, and I always find it kind of interesting, you know, what the tipping point is, you know, in each case. And I think that, you know, for Roy DeMeo, it's pretty clear here that, you know, he's a guy who's out to do whatever it takes, and he's just, nothing is going to get in his way. And I mean, he comes up with this, as you mentioned, the Gemini method would be one of his lasting legacies, in his particular style of body dismemberment, which maybe tells you more than anything else what kind of a guy Roy DeMeo was.
Yeah, the problem that Roy had also, though, you know, in the early 70s was he, you know, was getting into his 30s. He was making money. He was doing things for the Gambino family. He was dependable. He was making money for Gaggi. He was kicking up. He was doing everything he had asked to. He had even made his bones, but he still wasn't made. And I think that's something that he kind of wondered about as the 70s went on. I kind of want to, before we get into a lot of the other things that Roy was involved in, I want to talk about the Gemini method, because the thing that Roy was known for was, as the 70s would go on, Roy was the go-to for multiple families, not just the Gambinos. He was the go-to murder crew, him and his people. And I kind of want to take right from the, you know, information that the FBI would learn many years later. The process of the Gemini method, revealed by multiple crew members, was the goal was always to lure an individual to the Gemini Lounge. There was an apartment in the back. And at that point, you'd walk in, you'd think you're going to a meeting. Almost instantly, DeMeo would appear with a silenced gun in one hand and a towel in the other. He'd shoot them in the head. And then with his other hand, he would quickly grab the towel and mask it around the head to basically staunch the blood flow, kind of like a turban or some kind of, you know, towel on it. Yeah, like some kind of mask on the head, basically, just to staunch that blood. You didn't want that blood coming out. Almost instantly as well, Chris Rosenberg would come out of nowhere, stab the victim in the heart to prevent blood from pumping out. They would then kill the individual almost instantly. They would strip the individual of their clothing. They would have the hooks above a shower. They'd hang the person upside down for 45 minutes so blood would all drain out. They would then take the individual into a room where there was a bunch of plastic, and they would multiply cut the person up, the legs, the head, the arms, everything. They would then take all of that, put them in cardboard boxes, take them out to garbage dumpsters where they knew the pickup locations and times, and everything would go to the Fountain Avenue dump. Obviously, tons and tons of garbage are being collected. There would be no way of ever discovering bodies in a dump that size.
No. And I mean, if somebody ever did discover a body part, tying it back to a particular pickup or dumpster or person would be not virtually impossible. It would be impossible. So a very creative method, a very gruesome and very gory method to dispose of a body, but effective.
But again, sure. No body, no crime. And that is the cardinal rule. We do not ever tell anyone to murder people. But generally, and the mob knew this, and this would actually come back to haunt the DeMeo crew years later, and I'll tell you why when we get to that point. If there is no body, there is no crime, for the most part. You're a lawyer, Blackjack. Is that true?
I mean, you don't need a body, but it is very
hard.
Very hard without a dead body to prove a homicide. I mean, if you think about it, it is the definition of reasonable doubt, right?
Yes.
How do we know the person didn't just up and leave?
Right.
Like, that's a legitimate question. People do it. People run away from their lives all the time, right? I mean, how do we know you didn't just up and leave?
Exactly.
It's the definition of reasonable doubt. And it's incredibly, incredibly hard and incredibly rare to see the government go forward on a murder charge without a body.
Exactly right. In the mid-70s, Nino Gaggia would call on Roy DeMeo to take care of something else. This goes to show you this story. This kind of goes to show you, if you fuck with a mobster, it doesn't matter when it is, they're never going to forget.
No.
12 years earlier, again, in the 60s, this would be 12 years from 1976. In 1964, Nino Gaggia is out. And an individual in Brooklyn, Vincent Governor, he was a local boxer. Him and Gaggia get into it. He gives Gaggia a black eye. For 12 years, Gaggia remembers this and says, I'm going to eventually get that motherfucker back. 1976, he says to DeMeo, look, this guy's got to go. By this point, Gaggia's involved his nephew, Dominic Montiglio. Montiglio was a Vietnam War veteran. He was an up-and-comer. So him and DeMeo say, hey, look, let's go get this guy. I have an idea. Governor was a veteran. He had a lot of, like, quirks with, like, grenades and stuff. He knew a lot about explosives. DeMeo says, let's blow him up. Let's Ooh. Rig his car. So they rig his car to a grenade pin, basically. So when he turns the car on,
pops the pin.
Yeah, pops the pin. So they spot Governor at a craps game. They rig the car. Governor comes out, turns the car on. It blows up, but it doesn't kill Governor somehow. It just, like, wounds him. Later that year, they would get another shot. This time, they're not going to blow him up. They're just going to shoot him. That worked a whole lot better. And that was that for Governor. So leave that as a lesson. If you ever want to fuck with a mobster, they're never going to forget. It could be years later. And generally, you're not going to hear anything. It's just going to happen.
Yeah.
By 1975, Roy and 76, Roy continues to make a ton of money. He's got the car theft stuff. He's got the loan sharking business. And as I said before, Roy and Gaggia would become partners in a peep show prostitution establishment. They were putting out a lot of porn, that sort of thing. But this is where things started to get kind of weird for DeMeo and Gaggia. Roy becomes heavily involved with certain pornography that, and look, some of the things that have said to have happened, I don't believe, but there were pornography that was putting out that was illegal. And I'm not going to get into what they were. Some of which, look, do I think Roy get into, like, really illegal, bad, terrible, demented things? No, I do not. If you know anything about Roy's family life, it wasn't going on. But Black Chick, Roy was dealing in some porn that you probably shouldn't be dealing in, or you shouldn't be dealing in, bestiality and things like that.
Yeah.
Gaggia finds out about this taboo stuff and is furious. He basically says to DeMeo, look, stop. I don't – listen, we can deal porn, you know, broads and stuff, but we're not doing that kind of stuff. And if you don't stop, I'm going to kill you. Roy kind of takes it and says, you know what? All right, I won't do it, but still is doing it. The whole Gaggia thing, and this is where the mob – they kind of say, look, I'm going to say I don't want you doing it, but as long as you keep paying me, it's out of my hands. And that's kind of how it was. But – you know, Roy was meddling in some weird shit. And this is where he starts the small connection to Richard Kuklinski. Kuklinski was involved in the 60s and 70s in lucrative pornography movies. And he starts trying to muscle in at one point to DeMeo's stuff. And there was an interaction between these two where DeMeo basically beats the shit out of Kuklinski with a gun and says, hey, stay the fuck out of my shit. And that was the only connection they had. Richard Kuklinski never killed anyone for Roy DeMeo. He never killed anyone for the mob. He was a serial killer. Okay. If you, one thing about Kuklinski that I do believe is stuff that the police and it came out in court. Richard Kuklinski killed just random individuals. You know, if you looked at him wrong, he would kill you. He would stab people with needles that had AIDS in. Like, he was a weird dude. He was a demented dude. He was a serial killer. He was no different than Gacy or you know, all these guys. He was a fucked up guy, but he was not a mob hitman. That's who he was. He was not a mob hitman. That's the only connection he had to DeMeo.
Yeah, I don't understand the people that are obsessed with Richard Kuklinski as being related to the mob in some sort. I mean, I know Kuklinski has said it in the past. He's tried to make the allegation, but Kuklinski said a lot of crazy shit. And you're right. Anytime you put a tweet out about, you know, hitmen or dangerous guys or whatever, people will inevitably mention Richard Kuklinski, and it just doesn't fit. I mean, it just does not fit.
Yeah, and Kuklinski would later talk about how he killed, you know, hundreds of people, and he used all these different methods. And look, did Richard Kuklinski kill with cyanide and stuff? Yes, for sure. But again, he did not kill for the mob. He would say years later that he was at the Paul Castellano hit and, like, you know, all this different stuff. And look, the information that they put out in those Iceman tapes where the psychiatrist interviews Kuklinski, yep, like, that's interesting shit, but most of it's just not true. Richard Kuklinski was a manipulative liar. He lied about a lot of stuff. So yeah, that was his only connection to DeMeo, and it was a very brief one. By this point, though, in the 70s, DeMeo would start to be kind of rooted around by the feds. The IRS starts looking into some of his income stuff with some of the stuff he had with credit unions that he was a part of. They would also start looking into his auto theft ring and that sort of stuff. But by the late 70s, DeMeo starts to get kind of irritated. He wants to be made. He wants to take, obviously, the fact that he's powerful to another level. He is doing a lot for the family, and he wants to be compensated for that. He wants to be made. It's pretty simple, right? Yep. But the books were closed. Carlo Gambino didn't have them open. Castellano was kind of towards the end of Carlo's life. They were both pretty integral in making decisions for the family. And they almost, in a way, especially Paul, looked down on people like DeMeo. DeMeo was the grunt, right? He was the guy that killed people. And we're not going to really make him. Maybe at some point we'll do it, but he's got to give us a real reason to. In the fall of 1976, Carlo Gambino would die of natural causes. Paul was named boss. Now, for Gaggi, at least, Gaggi liked Castellano for the most part. He knew that he would be elevated, and he was elevated to capo. So while Gaggi and other people were pissed off about Castellano, Gaggi was okay with it. And in turn, DeMeo kind of got in line and would hope down the road that this would open the books. But as we know with Paul, sooner or later, people would really get sick of him because of his white collar nonsense and, you know, the fact that he looked down on people like Gaggi and Roy DeMeo. One of the big breaks would come in the late 70s for DeMeo. DeMeo would get his induction into the crime family through something big, through an association that he had. He forms an alliance with a group on the west side of Manhattan called the Westies. The Westies were an Irish-American gang. What was going on was the Westies were starting to muscle into the labor rackets and things of that nature. Construction was booming in New York. And there was a guy that ran the Westies, Mickey Spillane, that was causing a lot of headaches for the mob, particularly Paul Castellano. He was kind of muttering into the Javits Convention Center and really kind of pestering delays in construction. And Castellano was getting sick of it. So DeMeo kind of, through Gaggi, kind of broker an alliance between up-and-comers in the Westies, a guy called Jimmy Coonan that wanted to become the boss of the Westies and kind of create an alliance with the Gambinos. There was one problem, Spillane. So they order DeMeo to take out Mickey Spillane, the DeMeo crew. That would in turn elevate Coonan, and Coonan would in turn align with the Gambinos. All the construction would get back to normal, and the Westies would have a good connection. And that would also help the Gambinos because they'd have another crew they could go to take care of business. And we'll talk about Jimmy Coonan and the Westies down the road. That was a pretty good partnership for both Blackjack, the Westies and the Gambinos. And Castellano would look at DeMeo and say, you know what? You kind of formed this alliance. This would get you your button.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense if you think about it. I mean, not only do you get rid of the delays in the construction projects caused by Mickey Spillane, but like you said, you're now getting – a cut of the profits from the Westies, which is nice. And Castellano certainly is interested in that. I mean, Paul Castellano cared about the bottom line more than anything else. So that helps. But now you also have access to an outside crew to do work for you, which puts a little bit of distance between the boss and some of these other activities, which at this time with, you know, the Justice Department looking into them very closely is certainly an advantage to have.
So when we're getting into 1978, Roy has it all. He's got money. He's got power. He's a made man in the Gambino crime family. He's the go-to hitman for the group. And, you know, he was an important part of that family. It's that simple. The next series of events that would happen would really begin the undoing of Roy DeMann, really set him up for a lot of bad things that will go on and really kind of shape his life till the end. In 1978, his crew member, Chris Rosenberg, was doing a lot of drug dealing. He was selling a lot of weed, a lot of cocaine, and Roy, he loved it because he was making a ton of money. They were selling large amounts of drugs. Chris Rosenberg becomes connected with an individual in Florida only called El Negro. Now, El Negro was a big-time drug dealer. He was a Cuban cartel member. Rosenberg gets an idea that we're going to buy drugs off of him. He's our new connect. The problem was Rosenberg had no plans to actually buy them. His goal was get these people up here. We'll rob them and then kill them. Rosenberg was a stupid guy, pretty clearly. The last thing the mob needs, particularly the Gambinos, especially in the Gambinos, because as we know, Castellano didn't want people selling drugs. The last thing they need is a war with a Cuban drug cartel.
No.
But Rosenberg sets this all up. This El Negro guy sends his, I believe, brother and girlfriend up to handle the deal. Rosenberg kills them, and this gets back to the Cuban guy. And obviously, he's furious. DeMeo becomes known to this drug deal that, hey, this isn't good. DeMeo goes into hiding, if you will. He goes out to Long Island and realizes he's got to figure this out. And he knows that Gaggi's going to come to him and say, Rosenberg's got to go. And Rosenberg had to go. This was completely ridiculous. This was an idiotic move. This was reckless. And it was going to probably be a downfall if Roy didn't handle it. But Roy becomes more and more paranoid. And his son Albert would talk about the years later that Roy becomes more and more paranoid. He's always looking out of the window. He's in hiding. He's worried about Cuban hitmen coming to find him, like in Scarface when Tony Montana crosses Sosa, right?
Yeah, kind of.
So Roy's looking out his window one day, and just by sheer chance, he sees a kid outside of his house that, according to Roy, looked Cuban. So Roy assumes this is a hitman, okay? He gets in his car and starts pursuing this individual. The guy gets spooked and sets off this crazy chase. And by the end of it, DeMeo and his crew member, Joe Guglielmo, kill this guy. So they get to the hitman before the hitman gets to them. The problem was the hitman was not a hitman. It was actually a college student called Dominic Ragucci. Ragucci was in college. He was working as a door-to-door salesman for a vacuum company. And this is – there are three levels to DeMeo's life that I think really fucked him.
Yeah.
His father and brother dying and this. There was one thing about Roy DeMeo. He didn't kill innocent people.
No.
People like Anthony Castlewood and others. But Roy had a staunch thing. I'm only involving people that are involved in my life. I don't take any of this shit home. And according to Albert DeMeo, Roy's son, this shattered him. He, in a fit of rage, killed an innocent person. And he was stalling, man, at the end of the day. He was stalling. He would say, Albert, that his dad would be in his den for days after this. He couldn't get past it. And Gaggi was infuriated through this because an individual died because you stalled and didn't kill Rosenberg. The Cubans wanted proof of death. They wanted to know Rosenberg was killed. Roy didn't want to kill Rosenberg. He was sad. That was like his son. But innocent victims were dying, and Gaji basically says to Roy, you got to stop fucking stalling. Kill Rosenberg, or we're going to have to deal with you. It's that simple. On May 11th, 1979, Rosenberg would be asked to report to the Gemini Lounge for a meeting shortly after his arrival. One single bullet was pumped into Chris Rosenberg's head. He would fall to his knees, but he wouldn't be killed. Weirdly, at that point, the usually ice-cold DeMeo kind of shook and said, I don't know if I can do this in his head. At that point, Anthony Center would pump four bullets into Rosenberg, killing him instantly. And this would be something that would shape the whole thing because Rosenberg was now dead, but the Cubans needed a proof of death. So they couldn't chop him up and throw him into a dump. The DeMeo crew would have to obviously throw him out on the middle of the street, and they wanted to have it public, right? The murder had to be public. And this would, down the road, fuck the DeMeo crew. But Rosenberg had to go, and innocent people died because of it due to DeMeo's kind of sitting on his laurels a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you understand it to some extent, right? I mean, Rosenberg was so close to DeMeo for so long, such an integral part of his kind of rise and ascension within the family that, yeah, it's not something you want to do. But at the end of the day, those are the rules, man. I mean, you get the order, you got to do it. He hesitated and wound up killing an innocent person, which, as you said, really kind of tormented him. And then right on the heels of that, he has to kill this kid who he thought of as like you said, as a son, and publicly dispose of his body. I mean, that's enough to fuck with anybody's head.
Yeah, it did. And they took Rosenberg's body, left it on the Cross Bay Boulevard, right near Wildlife Refuge, and it would later be found. Albert DeMeo, Roy's son, would later say that the Rosenberg murder would affect his father deeply. And quote, he went into his study room and wouldn't come out for 2 days. It was like losing a son. But Rosenberg was out of pocket and had to go. It would only get worse as Roy would continue to expand his car theft ring. It would also become on the purview of the FBI. Roy was shipping cars overseas. Became a huge operation. He was getting multiple people involved. And the FBI started to take notice. They would start to jam up old partners of Roy's. And, you know, that would become a concern because people like Vito Arena and Fred Denome were integral parts to those car theft rings. And, you know, they had become a problem for Roy. In 1979, Roy would have an interesting connection to another episode that we did. If you remember Louis Eppolito, who was the mob cop that had mob connections, Roy actually ends up killing Louis Eppolito's cousins after the cousins find out about the drug dealing that they're doing and they go to Paul Castellano. Roy gets wind of it and kills both of those two. So kind of an interesting connection there. But the FBI was kind of breathing down the necks of Roy DeMeo and the DeMeo crew by this point. It was hard to kind of get past what was going on. And this also started to kind of bother the Gambino crew. They had assumed also that DeMeo was kind of getting too hot. He was getting too reckless. There were too many things that were becoming public. And as we know, you don't want to be public in the mob. The FBI was investigating them, and people in the family started talking. And an FBI bug of the home of Angelo Ruggiero, they pick up a conversation that Ruggiero has with Gene Gotti, Gotti's brother.
Yep.
And they were talking about that Castellano wanted to kill DeMeo, but that he was having a problem doing it because nobody wanted to take the job. People were scared. And that just kind of shows you how dangerous Roy DeMeo was. Frankie DiCicco would sooner take the job down the road. But he would also mention that he didn't know if he could handle it either. And that probably the only people that could kill DeMeo were his own people, which kind of would, you know, come to roost later. Albert DeMeo, Roy's son, would continue to detail later about Roy's paranoia. He would always have a shotgun concealed underneath a jacket that he would wear. He kind of knew that time was ticking, right? And time was indeed ticking. In 1983, Roy DeMeo was summoned to a meeting at a crew member's home. His family would expect him that night. He would never show up, though, and that was not normal. Roy's son would discuss later that he would find his watch, wallet, and ring in his study room, which was not normal. And his Cadillac would be found 10 days later on January 20th, 1983, in the parking lot of a boat club in Brooklyn. The car was towed to a nearby NYPD detective spot, and his body was partially found in the back of the trunk. Roy DeMeo had multiple shots in his head and in his hand, which would ensue that Roy would try to put his hand up and try to fight. And at that point, the killers would open fire on him. It was a pretty brutal murder, but it had to happen. The DeMeo crew had realized, Gaji had realized, look, this guy's too reckless at this point. He's doing things. People are committing crimes under him. He has no control of anything. And the FBI is breathing down his neck. And people would find years later that the concern was Roy DeMeo could not possibly stand up to the stolen car ring. They knew the FBI was breathing down the neck of Roy, and the family members started to get worried. Roy became disposable blackjack. It's that simple.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about other guys and kind of their paths to downfall, and you can see it very clearly with DeMeo, right? I mean, first, he didn't have control over Rosenberg. The Rosenberg thing was an unmitigated disaster, getting fucked up with a Cuban cartel. That can't happen. Then the hesitation to kill Rosenberg leads to another high-profile death of a civilian. Then you're moving these cars, and they're moving cars, Jeff, at a massive rate in and out of the United States, shipping them internationally. That's going to draw attention. You know, the drug dealing is still going on. He's got IRS problems. I mean, there's just a swirl of trouble over the head of Roy DeMeo that, you know, they just can't tolerate. I mean, they simply can't tolerate it. So
the person that fucked DeMeo was the kid he met when the kid was 16. Rosenberg was the problem. Yeah. Rosenberg was not Italian. Rosenberg was an outsider for the most part in that group. And, you know, ultimately, really everyone in the group stayed in line except for Rosenberg. Rosenberg fucked them. And again, this is what the Gambinos had always talked about. This is what drug dealing gets you. You start interacting with people that are not part of our life. You go off the deep end. And most of this was because of Rosenberg's transgressions. But Roy had a connection to him. It was like a son. He was like a son. Yeah. In 1984, a Colombo crime family soldier, Ralph Scopo, would be overheard talking to an associate about DeMeo and why he was killed. According to Scopo, they had merely suspected he would also not be able to stand up to any legal issues that he would have. So it wasn't that he was just reckless. I think at the end of the day, they were in belief that he wasn't going to cooperate. And that's something that, interestingly enough, I think the problem that Roy DeMeo had was he a demented, evil guy? Yes, but one issue that you have, if you're a demented, evil person, but you also have compassion, that ain't going to work. You need to be a cold, callous individual, someone like Tommy Patera. It's just that simple. And I think they worried that Roy was not soft. I'm never going to call Roy DeMeo soft, but I think there was a question of could he stand up to some of the charges? And by that point, with all the other stuff, as you said, it was just time for him to go. In 1984, the FBI would, as we know, is a very public case. They would indict not only Paul Castellano, but 23 other defendants, including every member of the DeMeo crew, Nino Gaji, and as I said, Paul Castellano. All the charges would be, there would be a huge amount of charges, auto theft, racketeering, murder, drug trafficking, all sorts of stuff. And Castellano would be indicted for killing Roy DeMeo, as a host of other things. He would never see trial, though. As we know, in 1985, he was killed outside of Spark Steakhouse, which was ordered by Gotti. After Castellano was killed, Gaji would be the lead dog in that case. He also, though, would not face trial because he would die as well of natural causes. In 1986, six members of the DeMeo crew would be found guilty, including Henry Borelli, who would be found guilty of two counts of murder, and other individuals as well. In 1989, Anthony Center, Joseph Testa, and other people involved in the DeMeo crew would also be connected and charged with murder, including nine additional murders. And Testa and Center were given life sentences, plus 20 years for racketeering and murder. The prosecutor in this case had an interesting quote. He said that the Roy DeMeo crew is the most violent crew ever prosecuted in federal court, as far as my knowledge, and suggested that Roy DeMeo was engaged, quote, in wholesale slaughter. Ooh. It was said at one point by the FBI that there were up to 200 individuals that the DeMeo crew killed. Now, as far as the list of proven murders, it's about 46, which is a lot.
Still quite a bit.
A couple of them would include Andre Katz, who we talked about, Vincent Governera, Mickey Spillane, the Eppolito cousins, all sorts of individuals, informants, innocent individuals, and the final one, Roy DeMeo himself. A lot of the convictions were secured really in large part to informants like Fred Denome, who was the first person to introduce Roy DeMeo to a life of crime. Remember many years ago, Blackjack, he introduced him to the car theft ring. He was that mechanic. Denome would flip. And Dominic Montiglio would also flip. Montiglio was the nephew of Roy DeMeo. Montiglio is actually a pretty interesting guy. I know he's an older guy. I would love to talk to him. He's pretty interesting. He's still alive today, as far as I know. Montiglio turned when he learned that there was a contract on his life, and he would later be placed in the witness protection program. Denome was killed in 1984, and according to authorities, it was a suicide. I guess he just couldn't take it. Kind of some interesting things to kind of close with. Blackjack, the Gemini Lounge now is actually still around in Brooklyn. Take a guess at what it is now, the building.
The Gemini Lounge. Laundromat.
No. Surprisingly enough, it is a church. Somehow. So put that into perspective. The Gemini Lounge, where where tens of people were killed, is now a church.
Okay.
Look, I don't know if there's anyone that lives in the Flatlands that could go by, and I'm sure they would have to know, right? I mean,
they have to, yeah.
I mean, that's pretty crazy. We got to go to that church, man. There's got to be some evil spirits in that place. Holy hell. What a weird place. Yes, it's a Pentecostal church.
The Purpose Life Church.
There you go.
Wow. All right.
We got to interview those people, man. See if they know. We got to just go up. We're going to go up to that place at some point and just,
we have to make a stop there.
Do you know what this place used to be? A breeding ground of murder.
Yeah, can we just see the side door?
Yes, exactly. As we talked about, Roy had a son, Albert. He had a couple other children as well, two daughters. Both daughters are actually very successful people. One was a clothing designer. The other became a doctor, actually. Huh. Roy's son, though, would really take the brunt of his father's misdeeds and transgressions. He would write in a book, which is actually, I read some of it. It's actually quite good. It's called For the Sins of My Father. Roy's son would actually have a nervous breakdown right after the book would come out about his father. He would have a lot of PTSD. I've heard some bad things about his son as far as what's happened. And, it's really sad, man, because, we talk about the mob, Blackjack, I don't think glowingly, but we obviously talk about what they've done. We've watched movies about the mob, but, and I think this will go all in all back to the conversation we had earlier about, glorifying these people in these neighborhoods. But, I think the people that really obviously share the brunt that we don't ever hear about are really anyone that are the families of these people. People like Albert DeMeo, who I don't think ever was really able to have a real life because of the things that his father did. I think he obviously looked at his father as a great dad. He would talk about the fact that his dad would always be at events. He would always tell his son, go be go be something. But Roy's kid, as he got older, would read. He knew who his father was. I want to just share a quote from him that he wrote in the book. I grew up in a very normal household. Now, I read all this stuff about my dad, and it really upsets me. This was cathartic. I went into this book with noble intentions, but I now realize that I can't fix my father's image. He did kill. I know those things. I can't fool myself. But I can show that there was another side to him, a father who always took care of his family. And, you know, whether it's the Gotti children or, you know, Linda Scarpa or any of these kids that have kind of in turn maybe had to deal with the sins of their own father. You know, I think Albert DeMeo, I've always felt most bad for. Because Albert DeMeo, really outside of a book, I don't know that he ever wanted to try to make money off of his father's crimes, but I think he truly wrote the book because he had good intentions and that, you know, he just wanted to tell his story. It's really kind of sad that you know, he's kind of had to share the brunt of all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, listen, that is the hardest part with a lot of these guys, right, is the family stuff. Because as you mentioned, and I think it's particularly hard in a case like DeMeo, because it does seem like he tried to have a normal family life. You know, you mentioned he tried not to bring it home with him. He wasn't interested in, you know, going out with civilians, you know, trying to, you know, do harm to civilians. So, yeah, to his son, who probably looked at him like he was, you know, a superhero at times, yeah, you can logically in your mind reason and rationalize, okay, my father was this outside the home, but he was this in the home. But at some point in your heart, man, that just doesn't add up. It doesn't compute. You're always going to have this struggle that, you know, I can't imagine what that's like to live with. It's a god awful thing.
Yeah, it really is. As I said, throughout the DeMeo Cruz reign, they killed a lot of people. They're known as, you know, the most violent crew in the history of Cosa Nostra. It's that simple. I mean, you put them right up there. I mean, you know, Murder, Inc., obviously that happened, you know, many years ago in the, you know, 30s. But this was, you know, for sure the most violent group. You know, whenever you're going to talk about, you know, those hypothetical questions, if you could have one group to kill for you in the mob, who would it be? The answer is always either Roy DeMeo or Tommy Patera. Or, you know, Greg Scarpa. We've done some. I mean, the last 4 weeks have been very violent. These are the violent.
We need
episodes.
A turn. We need something that's a little lighthearted.
Well, we're talking about the mob, so there's not really much of that. You know, interestingly enough, do you want to hear about some of the people and why they were killed in the Gambino crew as we wrap up?
Sure.
All right. There were some good people that should have been killed that the DeMeo crew killed. A couple of them were, you know, people that were informants, and we can question whether they were or not. In 1978, the DeMeo crew would kill an individual called Michael DiCarlo. DiCarlo was ordered to be killed for, according to Lucchese Capo, raping a young boy. Yeah. He was shot, stabbed, and beaten by the DeMeo crew. His body was dismembered. You know, he should have been killed. So there's one person that was killed. Joseph Coppolino was killed and stabbed by Roy DeMeo after he was suspected of implicating DeMeo in a 23-ton marijuana shipment. So, you know, a lot of people were killed for very different things.
Oh, yeah.
One other one, Joseph Scordi, was killed in 1978. He was shot and bludgeoned by a sledgehammer. From Vito Arena and Richard Denome, after refusal to join Roy DeMeo's auto theft operation, his body was put into a concrete-filled barrel and dumped off a pier. Arena was sentenced to 18 years in prison for that murder. So when we start talking about the very terrible things the mob did, this is one of them, killing people that just don't want to play ball. Yep. And this goes back to the violence they did. So there you go. Roy DeMeo and the DeMeo crew. A fascinating look at the most violent crew in the history of the mob. There you go. The sit down. Another week, another dollar, another great episode. Blackjack next week, we will delve into another OC individual, an organized crime individual. Who it's going to be, you'll never know. I'll tell you what, we got to get a little Maybe we'll do an earner next week. You want to do an earner next week?
Yeah, that's what we need, a money guy.
Let's do a money guy next week. Let's do, you know, maybe we'll do like Meyer Lansky or somebody.
Yeah, there we go.
Violent, definitely did things that he shouldn't do, but
not like this.
Not as violent. I mean, listen, last 4 weeks, these are who we've done. Okay, Gregory Scarpa, Cabani Savage, Anthony Casso, and Roy DeMeo.
Yeah, I mean, that's the Mount Rushmore of death.
I mean, how many people did they kill, all four of them combined? A thousand people, maybe?
It's got to be close.
Yeah, pretty nuts. So, all right, there you go. Blackjack, great stuff as always. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you enjoy the show, you like what you're hearing, and you haven't subscribed, what the hell you wait for? Subscribe. Please tell your friends. Tell people that you think might enjoy this show. We're trying to grow this thing. We're trying to get as big as we can. Leave a subscribe. Make sure you comment and give us 5 stars on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. I'm the big man on campus, Jeff Nadeau. He's Blackjack Fletcher. We'll see you next week here on The Sit Down.